Hare Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
The last general classification system is based on the nature of induction, by which one obtains the knowledge of the invariable concomitance between the middle and the major terms of an inference. This system distinguishes among three types of inference. In the first, kevalanvayi, the middle term is only positively related to the major term. For example, all knowable objects are nameable. I think we did this. In the second, kevalavyatireka, the middle term is only negatively related to the major term. For example, whoever is dead has no pulse. This person has a pulse, therefore he is not dead. In the last category, unvayatireki, the middle term is both positively and negatively related to the major terms. This is the joint method of both anvaya and vyatireka. For example, all smoky objects are on fire. The hill is smoky, therefore the hill is on fire. No non-fiery object is smoky. The hill is smoky, therefore the hill is on fire. Right, both has it. We were on.
Oh, actually, from page 39, second paragraph, the
fourth type. Aha. Yeah? The fourth type of fallacy is asiddha, an unproved middle. In this type of fallacy, the middle term is not an established fact, but is an unproved assumption. For example, the sky lotus is fragrant because it has lotusness like a natural lotus. Here, the middle term, lotusness, does not have any substantial existence because such a thing as the sky lotus actually does not exist. The fifth is bhadita, a non-inferentially contradicted middle. Here, the middle term is contradicted by some other source of knowledge. Examples are fire is cold because it is a substance, and sugar is sour because it produces acidity. Here, cold and sour are the major terms, and substance, acidity, are the middle terms. The existence of heat and fire and sweetness and sugar is directly perceived by the senses. So one has to consider substance and acidity as contradictory middle terms. Therefore, the inference is fallacious. You know, in other words, the hill, basically you can see what it is. Now, the middle term, smoke, you know, as we were giving before, four, then is inferring the major term, fire. So we've dealt with that the connection between the middle term and the major term is not correct, right? But then you also have the element, it can be the middle term, as you designate it, is not correct. You can say that the hill is smoky, therefore there's fire, right? But if you look at it, it's not smoke, it's fog, right? So it actually, the middle term isn't correct. Does that make sense? You know, if the middle term is there, then you have to prove it and connect it to the major term, right? Then that'll prove the Since the minor term is connected to the middle term, the minor term will be connected to the major term. Yes? Yeah? So you're saying A is connected to B. Now B is connected to C. A is connected to C. Right? But if B, it doesn't actually exist. You know what I'm saying? So you can't establish your inference. You know, it's a lotus, but in any case, just like we said, is that if you're saying A is the hill and C is fire, and you're using B as smoke, but B is actually fog, right? Then you can't connect fog to fire. So therefore, you won't be able to connect fire to the hill. Does that make sense? Okay, so that you have all the different fallacies. In other words, if your middle term means you're going to have the topic of discussion, but if your middle term isn't correct and your middle term's not connected to the major term, then you can't establish your point. Right? So therefore, in an argument, someone's presenting something, that's the thing to look at. Is the middle term actually properly situated and connected? If so, then they have a strong point. Right? Now, then you have the overall point. Does their even process of talking about the hill and the smoke and fire have anything to do with what you're actually talking about? Because this is an example. You know what I'm saying? So it may be that it's actually a bogus argument, because they're connecting the wrong point to the wrong point. So their presentation of this logic of inference may be correct, but what the topic about which they're inferring actually doesn't have anything to do with your major topic. Does that make sense? Yes.
It's like what I brought the other day. You know, like when I was thinking that
yes, so
if my interpretation being wrong, my argument is not.
Yes, the argument itself was a good argument, but it was applied to the wrong point. Yes, so we're saying is that you always have to look, because you only have the three elements. You'll have A, B, and C. So A, generally, there's not much of a dispute about. Right? But B and C, then that's where the points will come in as disputation. Is what, is B actually correct? Is B actually connected to C? Right? Then you know, and then you've established that A and B are connected. So then you're worked. But if your point about A doesn't actually have any connection to the point in discussion. Does that make sense? That's why these points can be part of this, but at the same time separate. Like you can say, this is actually your analyzation of subject matter, right? It's through this nyaya, this logic. So this panchanga nyaya, that one stages one's going through in this, then is how things should be presented. Now, if somehow or another your point does not even connect with the point in discussion, you know? Does that make sense? So then there'll be a problem. Therefore, you can take tarka or argument or these, you know, spurious different things. These can all be, though they're simultaneously within the nyaya here, you know, this inference. But at the same time, they can be outside of it. Does that make sense? In other words, the discussion, your logical discussion, right, the tarka, is your presentation and the other person's discussion of it. So then it's part of it, and so you don't consider it as separate. Right? But now if what they're speaking is completely different from what you're speaking, there's no connection. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like you say, hey, you know, Isn't today Wednesday? I don't think so, because this morning we had, aardvarks were seen flying over New York. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't have anything to do with anything. You know what I'm saying? Unless, of course, there's a particular day of the week that the aardvarks always fly over. So then it's like, I think it's Tuesday. No, it's got to be Wednesday because the aardvarks. If it was Tuesday, you know, then the pink elephants and tutus would be flying over. Right? So, but if there's no connection between the two, then, you know, if the whole thing is not proper. So therefore, it's just an argument. And the argument is based on improper, founding. Or foundations. Does this make sense? So that's why these last terms, you know, that we see on, on page 17 in table 1, this 3 through 16, the doubt, these different things, they may be correct in the whole process. In other words, these are the processes through you may go through in applying the, you know, point one on point two. Does that make sense? Point two is going to be what is your minor. Right? Does that make sense? Then through one, the four sources of valid knowledge, you'll be trying to establish some aspect of inference connected to those 12 objects of knowledge. Right? And then the methods that you'll go through, besides the logic, then the elements of discussion or argument in that, you use these systems 3 through 16. Does that make sense? But some of those that fall directly within the four sources of knowledge, how they actually work, but at the same time they can fall outside because you may be using them incorrectly. You know, so it is Tarka, or it is this, or it is that, but it actually doesn't make your argument any valid. You know what I'm saying? So that's why it would be classified in both. Does that make sense? Kind of, yes?
Mark, I don't understand the third type of fallacies.
The third type of fallacy.
Sat-pratipaksha?
The sat-pratipaksha.
Yeah.
Inferentially contradictory middle. Okay. This type of fallacy arises when the middle term of an inference is contradicted by the middle term of another inference that proves a completely opposite fact about the major term. For example, the argument, sound is eternal because it is audible, is contradicted by the inference, sound is non-eternal because it is produced as a pot is produced. The distinction between a contradicting middle and an inferentially contradicting middle is that in the former, the middle term itself proves the contradiction of its conclusion, while in the latter, the contradiction of the conclusion is proved by another inference. In other words, one itself, it proves it wrong. The middle itself proves your theory wrong. So that is that there's no opposing argument. You defeated yourself. You know what I'm saying? The second one is that the other party has another contradictory point using the same line of thought. You know what I'm saying? So they define it differently. So their middle term contradicts your middle term.
But it must contradict their middle term in a more logical way.
Yeah, but the point is it's got to be whoever has the best presentation wins. But the point is, in other words, your point becomes fallacious because the other one is better, has a better standing. You know what I'm saying? But the point is what we're saying, these things may or may not be connected with this process, right, 3 through 16, is because you may even use a fallacious argument, but you may win the debate. Right, because the other person couldn't catch what were the wrong points. You know what I'm saying? So you could win. You could have, you know, give the final point. You could clear all doubts. You could do all the things that the discussion will do, but at the same time, you still established a bogus point. Does that make sense? Okay. So does this make sense here? Okay, comparison. According to Nyaya, comparison is the third valid source of experiential knowledge. This kind of knowledge comes when one perceives the similarity between the description of an unfamiliar object and its actual appearance before one's senses. Okay, one sees a similar description of an unfamiliar object and its actual appearance before one's senses. For example, suppose that a trustworthy person has told you that there is such a thing as a crab apple that looks like a regular red apple, but is smaller and has a longer stem. One day in the woods, you come upon a tree bearing fruit you've never seen before, but it reminds you of apples. You then remember your friend's description of crab apples, and you come to the conclusion that this must be a crab apple tree. Right? That makes sense. So, in other words, you're comparing something. Someone's told you something, and then you come across the object, though you don't know what it is, but you compare it to what you've heard, but you technically don't actually know if they connect. Right? This source of knowledge, upamana, is not recognized as valid in many of the other systems of Indian philosophy. The Charvak system of philosophy, for instance, does not accept this as a source of knowledge, because the system maintains that perception is the sole source of valid knowledge. Right? In other words, if you're only going on perception, then you wouldn't use it because you're only comparing it. Because you've seen apples, you've seen these, but you actually don't know if the definition that the person gave you is the same. You know? So then those who just go on perceived knowledge then won't accept it. The Buddhist system of philosophy recognizes upamana as a valid source of knowledge, but regards it as a mere compound of perception and testimony. Right? In other words, because you are perceiving it, therefore it's just part of perception. Right? So they break it down in there. They don't leave it as a separate system. The Vaisheshika and Shankya systems explain upamana as simply a form of inference. And the Jain system maintains that it is merely a kind of recognition. The Mimamsa and Vedanta systems agree with Nyaya in considering upamana as an independent source of knowledge, but they explain it in a different way, which will be discussed in the chapter on Mimamsa. Okay, so this is because it's not one of the primary systems you'd use because it's very hard to connect it. Well, how do you connect it? Because you're just going by what someone said. But it's based on some form of authority. You know, so it has good. So from authority, you've come to perception, but you're not exactly sure, right? It could be a pomegranate, right? It's small, it's red, you know, it has a stem, you know, something like that, you know. Okay, so in Mimamsa, then this will be discussed. So it's an independent source of knowledge, but at the same time, it's not very solid. So not testimony or shabda. Shabda, or testimony, literally means words. It is the knowledge of objects derived from words or sentences, and is, according to Nyaya, the fourth and final source of valid experiential knowledge. Not all verbal knowledge, however, is valid. In Nyaya philosophy, shabda is defined as the statement of an apta, a person who speaks and acts the way he thinks. Right? Yes.
Well, it was like someone with realization.
Yeah, you could basically say like that, because they would make, in other words, what he's talking and what he's living, you know, or doing would be the same. But otherwise, he speaks one thing and does another, then you wouldn't necessarily take it as shabda, you know, authority. Though in some cases you can. You know what I'm saying? Like you have sometimes like a sinful person, because of the nature of, means if they're thoughtful, then they can see the difference in results of sin and of piety. But either due to habit or the situation they're in, then they're engaged in sinful activity. Now, you could take a lot of instruction from them on the benefits of piety and the, you know, bad qualities of sin. because they do have realization, even though they themselves don't practice it, right? The piety. But they can give you example from the negative, right? In other words, you can prove something positively, or as we mentioned before, in the Nyaya, you can establish it negatively. Yeah? So that, therefore, that's why it says you can take gold from a dirty place, you know, like that. You can take, advice or wisdom from, you know, just a common or a low-class person. You can take a girl who's got good qualities, even though she's born, in not such a good family. So all these you can get from another place, because these are exceptions. You know, the general thing is someone's sinful, they're not thinking about it. Right? But some people do think about it. Like that. So an apta means the person acts and speaks in the way he thinks. In other words, the person, the way he speaks, he actually believes that. But it's not so ideal because he's not acting that way. So you take some understanding from that, but your main source of authority on that would be someone who is acting in that way. Does that make sense? Such a person's mind, action, and speech are in perfect harmony. And he is therefore accepted as an authority. Thus, his verbal or written statement is considered to be a valid source of knowledge. The Veda is considered to be the expression of certain venerable aptas, great sages who realized the truth within and who transmitted their experiences into words. The validity of the Veda is derived from the authority of these aptas. Okay. So in other words, it means a person. So here, a person can also mean God. Right? So you could definitely say, the supreme apta. Right? Then there's his associates, other great personalities. So this is what is there in Shabda, in Shastra. Right? You have the Veda, and you have all the Smriti Shastras, which are all discussed or spoken by great personalities, great sages. That makes sense? So therefore, then, all this becomes bona fide. The validity of verbal knowledge depends upon two conditions. First, the meaning of the statement must be perfectly understood. Second, the statement must be the expression of a trustworthy person, that is, an apta. There are two main ways of classifying shabda. In other words, the statement's coming from bona fide authority, and you have to understand it in the correct way. Right? If that's there, then you're acting upon shabda. Right? Does that make sense? Otherwise, they may speak, it's correct, but you don't understand it, you won't apply it properly. So then you can't use them as an authority. Right? Because you didn't understand. Does that make sense? Like that. So, yeah. So the point is the understanding, therefore the teacher is trying to teach, but the student must be trying to learn. Because it doesn't say here, it's depending upon how well the apta explained it to the other person. Knows how well it's understood by the person who's going to use it. Does that make sense? So if you don't understand, then you ask, right? That's the point. You can't say, well, I didn't understand. No, it's your business to understand. If it doesn't make sense, then you have to make it make sense. Yes? There are two main ways of classifying shabda. The first method of classification divides testimonial knowledge into two categories. Okay. So it's good. It's like there's two parts, and then you take each of those two parts. And then in this part, there are two parts. And then in that, each of there's two parts. And it just keeps. But everything's like that. You know, if we want to take Prashad, then there's, you could say.
Breakfast and lunch?
Yeah, you could take two parts, breakfast and lunch. And I would say more general. I would say as you have, the Prashad and those who are honoring the Prashad, right? But then in honoring the Prashad, you have two parts. You have breakfast and lunch. And then within breakfast and lunch, you know, both, you know, then you have the parts of... Yes, yeah, sweets and salt. You know what I'm saying? So it always just goes, that's always like it is. So it seems like it's a lot, but once you understand it, then it's actually very, very logical. Seeing that the topic is logic, so it better be logical, right? That would be the, what one would expect, logic from the system of logic. What do you think? Yes? That's logical.
Well, later I want to prove that this system is illogical.
Later we'll prove, no, what we're proving in here, in other words, what's been discussed up to now is the mechanics of it. So the system of Nyaya is one of the 14 books of Vedic literatures. So it's bona fide, because everything here we use also. Question is now, what is his purpose in using this system? You know what I'm saying? In other words, we use sadhana, he uses this. Logic, logic is his sadhana. You know what I'm saying? So what is his purpose in doing that? What is he trying to obtain? That's where the points of being bona fide or bogus will come in. Does that make sense? So the system of it being how to logically present something, that's correct. That's bona fide. Right? Okay. The first method, two main ways of classifying. The first method divides knowledge into two categories based on the nature of the object of the knowledge. The first category consists of the trustworthy assertions of ordinary persons, saints, sages, and scriptures on matters related to the perceptible objects of the world. Examples are the evidence given by expert witnesses in court, the statements of reliable physicians about physiology, and scriptural declarations concerning the performance of certain rites. The second type of testimony, and this is in the first method, consists of the trustworthy assertion of persons, saints, sages, and scriptures on matters concerning the supersensible realities. Right? So now what is it, supersensible?
That which is perceived by the subtle senses?
One would consider it that way because you talked about the actual observable gross through the senses. And so here, then you might take supersensible, meaning super meaning that is above. Right? But you could also possibly, you know, argument's sake, take super in the sense of uber. You know? So then that means it's very, very sensible. You know, very logical, very, very, just really down to earth. No? Yes. So now, which one it is, we'll see as the sentence unfolds. Examples are a physicist's assertion about atoms, a nutritionist's statements regarding vitamins, a prophet's instructions on virtue, and scriptural statements about God and immortality. Okay? So in other words, those things that are beyond the senses, or the one that one can't perceive. Right? So both of them are based where trustworthy persons, saints, sages, scriptures, about perceivable objects. Then the same trustworthy persons, saints, sages, the scriptures, on things that aren't perceivable by the senses. You know, at least not in the situation that they're in. Right? Does that make anything clearer? Yeah, see, that'll satisfy you. So what did you just, what revelation you just had?
I was just confused that because it's giving like the things that are perceivable and sociology, I took that as psychology, and that's not really perceivable, so I wasn't understanding.
No, but it is, but physiology.
Oh, is that what it is?
Physical, the body. physiology. It means how the body works and the mechanics. You know, the head bones connect to the shoulder bones connect to like that one. Okay? And that gets all the way down to the toe bone. Right?
Yeah.
So that's physiology. Okay. The second way of classifying Shabda, so that was the first. Right? So that is based on the object of the, based on the nature of the object. In other words, is the object gross, or is there an element of subtleness? Right, that's beyond the grossness. So that means it could be subtle, material, or it could even be spiritual. Right? So that's one way of classifying Shabda, right? So that one way has two divisions based on the nature of the object. Right? In other words, one is based on the nature of the object, but the object can have two forms, gross or subtle. Yes.
The second one also seems that not necessarily even subtle, just what you can't perceive by the immediate senses, like atoms. They're not subtle.
Yeah, no. It just means it's in other words, it in one sense has to be it's a super sensible realities. This means that you may have a way to get at them, but at the same time as it's not just right there that you can look at it and touch it. So now the second way, the first way was by classifying the object of knowledge. A bit early. Hare Krishna, sir. Oh, because we have class. Okay. Okay. The second way of classifying Shabda is based on the nature of the source of the knowledge. Right? One is the kind of knowledge itself, the object of the knowledge. The other is the source of the knowledge. You understand? Yes? No? Let's say one is about the rock. The other is about where's the rock from. Does that make any difference? Yes. Okay. Now we'll see. The method categorizes all testimony as being either scriptural or secular. Here the word scriptural refers only to the sacred writings related to the Vedas and to the Veda itself. The words of scriptural testimony are considered to be perfect and infallible. Secular Shabda is the testimony of fallible human beings, and therefore might be either true or false. Secular testimony that comes from a trustworthy person is valid, but the rest is not. Right? Does that make sense? So one is that it's coming from someone you consider an authority, right? But it's about perceivable or not necessarily perceivable knowledge. The other is Shabda. It is Shabda because it's coming from the Vedas, or it's coming from reliable people. Otherwise, it's not accepted. Okay. The Nyaya system gives a detailed description of the nature of Shabda, because testimony is considered to be a valid source of knowledge and should therefore be analyzed thoroughly. In a scripture or a testimony, words and sentences are used. But what is a sentence? What is a word? And what is the nature of their construction? Here, a sentence may be viewed as a group of words arranged in a certain manner, and a word as a group of letters or phonemes arranged in a specific order. The essential nature of any word lies in its meaning, and there must be specific rules governing the arrangement of words in the formation of sentences. Without such rules, the words spoken even by a trustworthy person, an apta, could be reordered to convey a different meaning from the one intended, or could mislead a common person because of the lack of clarity of meaning. Right? Yeah, people could take it, change it. It's just like the example is it's there. Everybody does it. But I'm saying the impersonalists are famous for word jugglery. They take a sentence and then, you know, break it in different places. You know, move the comma or break it into two sentences. Or this way, they change the meaning. Right? And they're saying unless one is very careful, even an apta, what they speak could be juggled by somebody. Now, in this connection, it's interesting to note that the other sampradayas, other than the, you know, Gaudiya Sampradaya, the scholars read Jiva Goswami's works. Because if you take a sentence of his, no matter what you do to it grammatically, you'll still come up with the same meaning. Like that. Nobody else has ever written in such a way. Right? And this, you know, means like the Sri Vaishnavas, they'll read it because of that. Because even Ramanuja, you can take and juggle it. Like by taking the grammar and moving things around and stuff like that. But Jiva Goswami, doesn't matter what you do, you just can't do that. So that's what makes him, when Prabhupada says he's a foremost scholar, then that's what's meant. Right? He sat in Varanasi for 20 years and studied logic. Right? So what we've been going over for the last couple of weeks, he studied that for 20 years. Right? So he was very good at it. Right? So his presentations were perfect. There'd be no loopholes anywhere. Okay. 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 Here we're going to go just a little bit more, then we'll stop. This will be like, he'll introduce this whole thing. Now he's going to talk about the whole process of logic. I mean, using in the words. The Nyaya system states that all words are significant symbols, and that all words have the capacity to designate their respective objects. This capacity of words is called shakti, potency. And in the Nyaya system, potency is said to be the will of God. Words used in a sentence have certain meanings because of the potencies within them. And that is why they express certain meanings in a particular context. So the ordering of words in a sentence is very important. In addition, Nyaya maintains that there are four other factors that are essential in the proper functioning of sentences. Without the fulfillment of these four conditions, a sentence cannot express the intended meaning. These conditions are anksha, expectancy, yogyata, fitness, sandhi, proximity, and tatparya, intention. Okay. So I think before we get into this, we will continue this. Today is what? Monday, right? We'll continue this tomorrow. Because otherwise we'll just start, and then we'll have to start over, and we'll completely forget everything about it.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.